Welcome to Dialogue Out Loud. My name is Margaret Olson Hemming, and I'm the co-editor at Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. I'm here with Matthew Harris, the author of the fall 2025 article, Saving the Constitution with White Christian Nationalism, Ezra Taft Benson, W. Cleon Skousen, and their attempt to solicit the help of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Matt Harris is a professor of history at Colorado State University Pueblo, where he teaches race and religion, civil rights, and legal history. He is the author and/or editor of numerous books and articles, including Second Class Saints, Black Mormons and the Struggle for Racial Equality, Watchmen on the Tower, Ezra Taft Benson and the Making of the Mormon Right, and Thunder from the Right, Ezra Taft Benson in Mormonism and Politics. He is the president-elect of the John Whitmer Historical Association. Matt, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Margaret. It's nice to be here.
I just want to jump into this really fascinating article. I was most interested in this relationship between Benson and Skousen and Hoover, but I'd like to hear first, what were the most surprising or unexpected findings you uncovered in these FBI files and correspondences between Benson and Skousen and Hoover?
Yeah, so I filed FOIA requests and I got a hold of these FBI files from Benson and Skousen. And what's extraordinary to me is, I think, two things, is the extent to which Benson and Skousen tried to enlist the aid of Hoover in their effort to save the Constitution, which is the title of the article. But what that looks like is they tried to get Hoover to speak in general conference. That was enough to me. They tried to get Hoover's writings to be studied by the priesthood and Relief Society folks in various wards. They tried to get him to speak at BYU devotional addresses. I mean, one can't imagine that, you know, BYU people would try to get Kash Patel to speak at a devotional address today. But this is equivalency. And also, what surprised me, I think, the most is that J. Edgar Hoover, who was a white Christian nationalist through and through, he used to send his agents to summer camps to study the Bible. His agents were overwhelmingly white. And the FBI director would frequently give speeches in which he would draw on a biblicist worldview. And anyway, what struck me the most is that when Benson and Skousen invited him to, you know, align himself with the LDS Church, that he turned them down. And it got to the point where even Ezra Taft Benson and his son Reed would visit unannounced Hoover in Washington. Washington would tell his aides, tell Mr. Benson I'm not here. You don't want to meet with him. And the reason why you didn't want to meet with he or Skousen is because they had become affiliated with the John Birch Society, an anti-communist fringe group. And Hoover said something interesting. He said that, this is an exact quote, he said that anybody who calls President Eisenhower a communist has something seriously wrong with them. And that was a Birch line that Benson had tapped into, and Skousen. And even though Director Hoover was very conservative himself, that was just going too far to call a five-star general communist. So that was interesting, seeing all of that behind-the-scenes stuff. I guess I'll say one more thing, is that Skousen would go on the speaker's circuit for the John Birch Society, giving these addresses in front of tens of thousands of people, some of whom were Latter-day Saints. And he would say the most shocking things. He would say something like, you know, communism has infiltrated the U.S. government. We all know it. We're aware of it. We, meaning the FBI. And take it from me, I used to work for the FBI. I know these things. I was a top-level lieutenant to Director Hoover. And then these folks would write in. This is all in the FBI file. They would write in to Director Hoover, and they would say, we just heard this, one of your top lieutenants, Cleon Skousen, say all these things at its speech last night. Can you verify it? Can you confirm that what he said was true? And Hoover would write back and he'd say, Skousen who? Barely knew the guy. So he's distancing himself from his former agent. And by the way, they were semi-close. That's not true at all. He knew him quite well. But the point is that Hoover wanted to give the impression that the agency was nonpartisan, which of course is not true at all. And so when Skousen tried to use the agency to further his own political agenda, that's when Hoover pushed back.
Yeah, I definitely got the impression that they were friends, but it wasn't exactly friends because the relationship was more one-sided. It seemed like Skousen and Benson, particularly Skousen, kind of wanted Hoover more than Hoover wanted Skousen. But I guess that makes sense with the power imbalance there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Skousen's a young man. He's trying to find his way in the world. Came to the agency in 1932, and he stayed for several years. I think it was early 30s. And he left in 51 when he was called to BYU by David O. McKay, the church president. And he went to, took a leadership position, I think working with alumni. And then it was shortly thereafter where President McKay told the president, Ernest Wilkinson, that we want Cleon teaching on the religion faculty. I mean, he has no credentials. He did not go to Duke Divinity School. And he's the proud holder of a bachelor's of law degree. And anyway, so he's also seen as a partisan firebrand. And so some of the titans on the faculty, like Sid Sperry and Hugh Nibley and a guy named Richard Lloyd Anderson, young faculty member, they were just repulsed that they would hire some partisan hack, as they put it, when they themselves had, you know, credentials. So anyway, so Hoover Skousen recognized that Hoover could advance his career. And Skousen was very good at what he did. And when Skousen announced that he was leaving the bureau, the last thing Hoover said to him was, "We value you so much, you'll always have a job here if you want to return."
Wow.
And so there was a friendship there. I mean, it wasn't the friendship where you went golfing together and you hung out, you know, over dinner and lemonade, but they did respect each other. And I think you put it nicely, Margaret, that Skousen felt more closely aligned with Hoover than the reverse. But there's no question that they had a cordial working relationship because the FBI files bear this out.
Wow. So explain, for those of you who haven't read the article yet, explain just the basic thesis of it. And then I would love to hear how unique was this Mormon articulation of saving the Constitution compared to other Cold War religious movements?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the thesis is how this idea of that the Constitution needs to be saved. Maybe I'll do your second question first in reverse order for a second. So in Latter-day Saint theology, as many of your listeners are probably familiar with, is that there's an old saying that goes back to the 19th century that the prophet Joseph Smith had allegedly taught. I say allegedly because we don't have contemporaneous accounts, or at least a firsthand account from the prophet. What we have is a second account later on that, you know, I heard the prophet say this. So that's kind of the sourcing on this. But anyway, the prophet allegedly said, taught this white horse prophecy in which this would be the mid-19th century, or before he died, I guess, in 1844. But the prophet allegedly taught that the elders of elders of Israel will step forth and save the Constitution from impending ruin. And the context, if he did say that, the context would be that, of course, the church is under assault from its critics. And one could read the Civil War into this, that the elders of Israel will save the country from impending ruin, which is always interesting. You know, how do a group of priesthood holders save the Constitution and the government? I mean, I've yet to have anyone explain this to me, but nonetheless, it's a useful trope, if you will, to elevate the importance of Mormon priesthood holders. And so that saying that Mormon elders will step forth and save the country and the Constitution and the government, it means essentially the Civil War and sectional imbalances. By the 20th century, the general authorities began to apply that trope to all of the various isms that are circulating throughout the world, fascism, Nazism, communism. And in 1918, Joseph F. Smith, who is then the church president, He denied that this was a church doctrine in General Conference, but it didn't stop people like Ezra Taft Benson and others using it, and Cleon Skousen. And so they taught it often, and it's really a partisan statement because by the 20th century, again, they're applying it to all these isms, including liberalism. And so when Benson talked about during the 1930s that we have to save, the elders have to save the Constitution, what he really meant was FDR, the liberal American president, and his social welfare policies are ruining the country and they're paving the road to socialism and communism. And it's people like the elders that need to stop that. And what was interesting, I'm writing a book right now on Hubie Brown, who's a liberal apostle. And Hubie, like most of the general authorities, I mean, they talk about the Constitution often. This is a faith tradition that elevates the Constitution where it's akin to scripture almost. Not unique, by the way, to other Protestants from the early 19th century. The differences with Mormons, I think, with the Constitution is they're, you know, elevating it to this priestly power extends well into the 20th century, where other Protestants sort of give up that notion in the 19th century. And of course, with Latter-day Saints, it's baked into the Doctrine and Covenants and other points of scripture. But so Hubie Brown talks about, say, about the Constitution and the divine roots of the country and all of that, but he never talks about anything saving the Constitution because he knows it's fueled by partisan politics. Mm-hmm. And so just in short, when Benson and Skousen are talking about saving the Constitution, what they really mean is saving it from liberals like Hugh Brown. And of course, Brown knows this, and so he never talks about this. And in 2010, there was an Idaho person, I think, running for, I think, governor. And he was talking about to the saints on the campaign trail, the saints in Idaho, vote for me. I'm going to save the Constitution. And I mean, you know, not really short on humility. And so this gets back to Salt Lake, and the church PR team releases a statement saying, we don't believe in this anymore. So this whole Cold Warrior rhetoric of saving the Constitution is the church will disavow in 2010. And of course, Mitt Romney will be asked about it in 2012 when he's running against Barack Obama. And Mitt Romney will very calmly and, you know, back away from it and sort of change the subject. He doesn't confirm or deny it, but he just doesn't want to, you know, deal with that sort of thing. So that's the saving the Constitution. And because Benson and Skousen thought that liberalism and socialism and all of that from essentially the New Deal was overtaking the government, they felt that they needed help. And that's why they reached out to J. Edgar Hoover, who hated the New Deal as well. And they really, and he was a popular guy. He wrote this best-selling book called Masters of Deceit. He didn't write it, his agents did. But he put his name on it, and it's basically this conspiratorial, you know, claptrap about there are communists in the bushes, there are communists in your pews, communists next to you in your university classroom, you know, communists everywhere.
Jumping and so, out behind bushes as you walk down the street.
That's right. They're everywhere. They're in the news media. You can't trust anybody is essentially the thrust of all of this. And so Americans are, you know, fearful of the Cold War. This would be the early 50s. The book came out in 58, actually. And so Americans buy this book. It's a bestseller. And weirdly enough, 3 months after Masters of Deceit is published, it obviously elevates Hoover's reputation even further. But Cleon Skousen's book, The Naked Communist, was published, which draws on Hoover's FBI reports. And so the Saturday Evening Post, Time, and Life magazine, they published these two anti-communist books in tandem, Masters of Deceit, Naked Communist. And so Skousen almost overnight is catapulted in this national figure. And President McKay in 1959 a year after the book is published, he will promote the Naked Communist in General Conference. And I was just on a panel with one of Cleon Skousen's nephews last week at a conference. And I jokingly said, you know, if President Nelson, who hadn't passed yet, but if President Nelson would recommend my book, Second Class Saints in Conference, I'd be thrilled.
Yeah, that's.
But anyway, so the church president and national news mediums, they make Skousen into this national hero almost overnight. And he's just absolutely giddy about this new fame. Because he recognizes that having a religious leader and a secular leader advance his work, it's going to sell more copies. and but also get the message out. And of course, Benson will look at this book and he will immediately ask the church president to have the church quorums, the priesthood brethren, study it. And interestingly enough, he didn't ask the sisters to study it, Release Society, because it was the priesthood brethren who were supposed to save the Constitution.
Women didn't have a role in that. Okay, well, that's in line. Okay, so you're talking about these two books coming out at about the same time, and in your article you draw a strong connection between Hoover's white Christian nationalism and Mormon racial theologies of the time. So, do you see this as a convergence of parallel ideologies or as a direct exchange of influence?
Yeah, no, it's definitely parallel. I mean, I don't want to suggest that Hoover influenced Benson and Skousen's views on race, because that's simply not the case. I mean, Skousen and Benson, of course, are Latter-day Saints, and they've inherited the church's racial teachings that obviously relegate Black Latter-day Saints to a second-class status. This goes all the way back to biblical curses and this idea that was taught in the late 19th century that Black people are fence sitters or less valiant in this pre-earth life. So they've inherited these racial teachings. And also they're influenced, of course, by the things that they consume, just like we are today, right? They're watching Benson in particular, and Skousen. They're listening to right-wing talk radio, which becomes a thing during the Cold War. So these sort of the Rush Limbaugh was not the first person to really blow this up. There were some guy named Billy James Hargis, guy named Clarence Mannion, and a guy named Dean Stormer. They're the ones who were sort of the pioneers of Cold War talk radio. And Benson listens to them a lot. And he writes his friends, including Skousen and others, he says, "You got to listen to this Mannion guy. He's making lots of good points about conspiracies, about all of this." And of course, they're segregationists. So Benson's consuming all this stuff. And so his views on race, and especially the conspiracy stuff, you know, that Dr. King's a communist and all that nonsense, Benson's getting this from right-wing talk radio and also the Burt Society. And then, of course, the theological stuff comes from his church. And so it's when Hoover starts to say terrible things about Dr. King and other anti-Black teachings, it was easy for Benson to accept all of this because he already believed it.
Yeah.
And Skousen is the same way.
Yeah. So I guess that makes me wonder, so how would you see Mormon racial teachings reinforce or diverge from Hoover's racial worldview? They're both sort of coming out of this same stew. Do you see points of strong divergence?
Well, let's do the convergence first. I mean, the convergence, of course, both Hoover and Benson and Skousen, and that they shared these white-centered theologies. There's no question. And they thought that, you know, that they just didn't respect Black people. In Hoover's case, Black people were dumb. They were easily manipulated by communists. They were just tools, as he puts it. I mean, he just had this incredibly vile view of African Americans, and he was not quiet about it. I mean, he hated Dr. King. He resented Dr. King's power and influence, especially in the Black community. So, with Benson and Skousen, of course, they couch more of their anti-Black views in theology with the curse and the less valiant stuff. But they're also buying into this stuff as well. I mean, he influences them. You ask about did Hoover influence them on race? And the answer is yes. It was Hoover that was the first propounded this idea that King was a communist and that he was taking his marching orders from the Kremlin. And when Hoover taught this and said this in public, Benson and Skousen and the Burt Society, they just lapped all this stuff up. There was no critical engagement about, you know, how do we know this? What's the evidence? None of that stuff. They were just presupposed to or pre-inclined to believe this. And I should just say for your listeners quickly why this came about. Couple of reasons that the Communist Party back in the 1930s was the first really it's at the 30s, it was mostly a white organization, and it was the first organization in the United States that really paid attention to racial justice. And naturally, over time, because of that, some Black folk migrated to the Communist Party. Keep in mind, too, this is a Great Depression when much of the country is unemployed and out of work, and Americans in general feel uneasy and they feel like capitalism has failed them. So they're now trying something else. And more close to home, a couple of former members of the Communist Party, a guy named Stanford Levinson and Baird Rustin, they were former members of the Communist Party, and they became inner close advisors to Dr. King. They were not practicing communists. They were no longer members of the party. And King was told that having these two guys in your inner circle is just sending out bad vibes, and people are going to make hay of this. And they did. And that's what Hoover did. And he had wiretaps. He knew they weren't active members. And by the way, King is a Baptist minister. Baptist ministers believe in a divine. They believe in the Bible. They believe in scriptures. Communists don't believe in this stuff. This is what's lost on people with trying to smear King into being a communist. He's a man of the cloth. He's a man of the book. And anyway, so they just use it to smear his name because Hoover hated King to begin with, and he had such disdain for African Americans in general. And Benson and Skousen just bought off on this stuff. And I want to say this for your listeners. One of my pet peeves is that when people of all different political or religious persuasions, they tend to think that Benson is he speaks for the church. You know, if he thinks that King's a commie, then the rest of the brethren must think that too. That is not true. And I think it gets confusing because the brethren, most of the brethren don't support civil rights. That's true. But they don't support civil rights because they think King's a commie. They don't support civil rights because they're afraid that it will create a Leviathan state if you produce civil rights legislation. That is, you have to have a federal bureaucracy oversee it. These are orthodox conservatives. These are states' rights people. It's a wholly different argument for opposing civil rights than to argue that somehow it's being fomented by Moscow. And I frequently will say this when I'm on the lecture circuit, and I found no evidence that the top 15 leaders, the Quorum of the 12 and the First Presidency in the 50s and 60s, other than Benson, believed that King was a communist. And I've been through their diaries and journals. There's just no evidence for it.
Well, this is so interesting. I could listen to you for another half hour talking about these things. Really encourage everyone to check out this article about this relationship between Benson and Skousen and J. Edgar Hoover. And how these ideas of white Christian nationalism were influencing the church and the US government at the time. Thank you for listening. And listeners can find articles on dialoguejournal.com and sign up for the newsletter to stay informed of upcoming events. Thank you, Matt, so much for being here.
Thanks, Mario. It was a pleasure.
And you can listen to all articles on the Dialogue Audio podcast feed. Dialogue Out Loud is produced and edited by Daniel Foster Smith, and our social media manager is Emily Jensen. Thanks for listening.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.